since vaccination. While two doses of the vaccine provide protection against symptomatic disease upwards of 80% or 90% with Delta, with Omicron it drops to about 70% for mRNA vaccinations and 40 to 50% for AstraZeneca. Once receiving a booster shot, though, protection increases to 70 to 80%. Deborah Cromer says, "Very early on when the original strain was circulating, we were asking how much protection someone who has the disease had from getting the disease again." She adds, "The trials show people who'd had the Pfizer vaccine primary dose have twice as much immunity as someone who's recovered from normal virus. But all vaccines are primarily giving you immunity targeted against the original strain." Deborah Cromer says, "Once someone has acquired the virus, they have specific immunity against that variant, as well as some general immunity against SARS-CoV-2. She says, "You're less likely to get the same variant again, but you're certainly not completely protected. Nevertheless, we would expect it to be less severe. Protection will grow like what we see with the flu now." While COVID-19 has some key differences from the flu, Dr. Deborah Cromer says similarities exist, as it is possible to have both viruses without symptoms or without mild symptoms, and repeated exposure encourages the body to have good immunity. Deborah Cromer says that's probably where COVID-19 will eventually go, adding, "Each time you experience a SARS-CoV-2 infection, your immunity will be boosted somewhat, which would mean the next time you'll still have some immunity remaining." Clancy Reed first tested positive to the virus during Fiji's second wave in August of last year. Living in Suva, she and her family had lived a relatively COVID-free life until the disaster happened in April. She says, "We were a close contact and all went and got tested. My daughter, who was 2 at the time, was the only one who came back positive," adding, "We were moving houses, it was just a disaster, so we isolated by ourselves, and as soon as we got to the new house, I got really sick." She noted, "It was in the chest, in my breathing. I'd be laying there in the middle of the night thinking, oh God, at what point do you say I need to call it and seek medical attention?" Clancy Reed thinks that if she had been in Australia, she would have admitted herself to hospital, but feared being split from her husband and daughter and getting sicker alone. She says, "The hardest part was not knowing how bad it was going to get. The psychological symptoms were just as bad as the physical ones. Then, after months of slow recovery, the Christmas period arrived and Clancy Reed tested positive again." She says, "We all got sick and I assume it was the Omicron variant. I was flattened for 2 weeks, but it wasn't as frightening. I wasn't in tears in the night thinking, oh my God, am I going to die?" She says, "Now the families that haven't had COVID are nervous. They want to get it over and done with, whereas we're happy to be out and about together. There's an element of relief." Deborah Cromer says that as the pandemic continues, it wouldn't be particularly unlikely to be reinfected with the virus. She says, "We've had a relatively small time window for people to have repeated infections in Australia. It might be unlucky now because of that. But from a theoretical point of view, having COVID is not special. You get some level of immunity from having had the disease before and some from vaccination. Both will boost your immunity." Eleanor is still suffering from her exposure to the virus. She first tested positive to COVID at the start of January during the Omicron wave, after her housemate contracted the virus. Eleanor, who did not want to use her surname, had a range of symptoms: headaches, diarrhea, shortness of breath, insomnia, which began to subside within a few days. But then her second housemate returned from work out of town weeks later and tested positive upon his arrival. This time she had different symptoms: fever, chills, cough, and swollen glands. Eleanor is normally an active person. She does rock climbing as well as regular workouts with a personal trainer. She says, "Now I have shortness of breath, a racing heart. I really struggle with exercise and get puffed really easily. And I have an ongoing cough triggered by laughing." She concludes, "I get frustrated by people saying it's a minor cold or flu. I'm a healthy 33-year-old and I've had shortness of breath for over a month now. Getting COVID twice is more than enough."
What would have happened if Hezbollah had been vanquished? That's perhaps the most significant and upsetting question about the 2006 war. How did Hezbollah defeat Israel?
Part 3.
Much has been said about the 2006 war, about its motives, the behind the scenes, and the circumstances around it, its planning and developments, its details and objectives, as well as its outcome and the lessons learned from the war. Also, much speculation has been made about what led to the war. When considering the situation in Lebanon, in the occupying Zionist regime, in Palestine, and in the region, as well as the U.S. role in the war. One of the main issues that needs a close look is what would have happened if the resistance in Lebanon was defeated.
Speaking of a hypothetical defeat would not be possible without examining the history of Arab defeats. Just as one cannot hypothesize about Hezbollah's defeat without taking into account the nature and identity of the supposed winner. There are two other questions that have to be asked. One is, how did Israel overcome the Arabs? And the other is, how did Hezbollah defeat Israel? Only then can one hypothesize about the consequences of a Hezbollah defeat in the 2006 war. The World Cup opening match was held between Argentina and Belgium. On that day, the Lebanese capital Beirut was under attack by Israeli fighter jets and tanks that had the city under siege. Beirut siege happened during the World Cup, where two Arab nations, Kuwait and Algeria, were present.
Polemico del Mondiale spagnolo lo si ebbe quando la Francia del consiglio di Carlo Tardelli, cosa con due reti di vantaggio segnate da Jean Guin sul calcio di punizione.
Algeria beat Germany, and Kuwait Football Federation chief Fahad Al Ahmed Al Sabah halted the Kuwait-France match to protest France's fourth goal. He fought for 7 minutes, and the referee was forced to annul the goal.
Tuttavia non era partito dal fischietto dell'arbitro sovietico, ma evidentemente
كانت تشتد تحديا فعندما يزداد القصف يزداد التحدي.
As Israelis stepped up their bombing campaign, battle intensified. We thought Beirut burning under fire would shock the world, that the world will react to landing of a mortar, al-Burj al-Barajna building in the city, and the death of at least 75 innocent humans. We witnessed rallies in Algeria, but we later realized that they were just cheering for Algeria's victory against Germany in the World Cup.
Demonstrations were held across the Arab world because they thought Algeria's elimination from the World Cup had been a fix. But no one took to the street for the occupation of the second Arab capital after Al-Quds. Before the establishment of Hezbollah, Lebanon had seen several conflicts with Israel. There were two kinds of wars. Firstly, the partisan and army battles where national and Palestinian resistance groups were involved. And secondly, the battle fought by the Syrian army in the 1982 Lebanon-Israel conflict. In 1982, Israeli forces were double the combined number of troops Syria and Egypt had deployed in the October 1973 war. But Israel faced two different forms of resistance, military and non-military, in Lebanon. But how did Israel achieve victory against them? The natural elements of the Lebanese battlefield and its complex geography with its heights and narrow passes through the mountains left Israel no option but to employ new tactics. The strategy relied on heavy use of infantry and greater use of units than Israel dispatched for the 1973 war, but across a smaller area of only 70 kilometers. Israel used the maximum number of troops possible to take control of main crossways and sensitive points, overlooking key towns and cities, while taking hold of key geographical locations. To be able to reorganize its forces, Israel wanted a second portion of its troops to quickly advance towards Beirut, while the first groups had resistance forces encircled. The second group was to be supported by special forces, who would provide them with their needed equipment deep in Lebanese territory through marine or air transport methods. However, the Israeli army faced a demographic factor, a major geostrategic element in the war. They didn't have the needed experience to fight in urban and residential areas. Classic armies naturally avoid entering populated areas to prevent troop casualties, since such areas are full of buildings that limit movement. The Israeli forces were built upon heavy armored units supported by infantry, but Tel Aviv had not improved its infantry tactics, despite the fact that its troops had to fight face-to-face battles against popular resistance forces to be able to encircle them. The low number of Israeli infantry units gave the Lebanese and Palestinian resistance groups the opportunity of free movement and of engaging Israeli forces, though they failed to use the existing opportunity. The Lebanese National Resistance Front and the Palestinian Resistance Forces retreated as the classic Israeli army advanced into Lebanon, that was done in accordance with non-military principles without undermining their policy of confrontation. This is what Chinese leader and one of the most significant guerrilla war theorists, Mao Zedong, used to say. He said, "Escape when an army attacks you, confront it when it settles down, and follow it when it retreats."
Yasser Arafat used his entire experience of guerrilla wars. He had access to the experience of a full range of resistance movements, including those from Russia and Algeria, as well as weapons from across the globe. The Japanese also helped him, along with their Red Army, German guerrilla group Badr-Menov Group, and Italy's Red Brigades. All of them sympathized with the Palestinian issue, as they had Arab countries' facilities at their disposal, and even had interests in the Arab oil oil industry. The Palestinian resistance staged a hard-fought partisan battle since the very establishment of the Zionist regime. The battle had a history of ups and downs, both in Palestine and outside, including in Jordan and Lebanon. Therefore, it was not a domestic guerrilla war, and there is no partisan battle except that it gains victory. This is a historically recognized fact based on the experience of the wars of the past.
On October 6th, the Israeli army, equipped with large numbers of Merkava tanks, launched a pitched battle against Lebanon. Israeli forces began advancing along several axes with a focus on the coastal areas. One of the most important classic battles of the 1982 war took place here in this place, where Israeli and Syrian armies engaged in the Battle of Sultan Yaqub. During the battle, Syrian army forces inflicted heavy damage on Israeli armored personnel carriers that stopped them from advancing. In just 5 days, the Israelis managed to extend their domination to two-thirds of Lebanon. That was when they realized the road to Beirut was all clear. They were finally within kilometers of the Lebanese capital on June 9. On that day, Lebanon witnessed one of the heaviest air battles in modern times.
كان البقاع ولا يزال جزءا من النطاق الأمني السوري إلى دمشق وسوريا.
Beqa has always been part of Syria's security margin for Damascus. Therefore, Syria has to keep its security presence at the border town to make up for Lebanon's weak border security in the valley. If not, Israelis could use the Beqa area to enter Lebanon, while military forces in Bilad al-Sham, Greater Syria, which is 30 kilometers away from Beqa, could not defend the area. Therefore, Syria had to set up its defenses from outside of Bilad al-Sham and deployed its SAM-6 anti-air defense system to Lebanon to that end. The key issue here is that back in 1982, the Israeli enemies wanted both to get rid of the Palestinian Liberation Organization and prevent Arabs, especially Syrians, from repeating the victories they gained during the 1973 war. Arabs could reduce Israel's air superiority through creation of a semi-active air defense system, providing more ease of movement to Syrian and Egyptian forces. The advantage cost Israelis part of their air force and surprised them for a short period of time, providing the Arab side of the war with a sort of a victory. In fact, all of that was an achievement of the air defense systems of Egypt and Syria, especially the latter's, as Syrian soldiers used the air defense system with ultimate skill.
In June 1982, the Israelis resorted to destroying missile systems in an attempt to prevent limited successes of the Arabs in the October War. After the destruction of the air defense systems, Syrians deployed 100 aircraft to counter the Israelis' air assaults. The Israelis responded with ambushing the Syrian fighter jets. One of such tactics was the use of F-16 aircraft able to tackle air-to-air missiles of Syria's MiG-23 fighter jets, leading to the destruction of a large number of Syrian jets, up to 36 of them.
In 1982, the Syrian army faced a large-scale attack that led to many deaths. They forced Syria out of southern Beirut and the Jabal area and besieged Syrian forces in Beqa. They pushed the large Syrian contingent out of southern Beirut. The 85th Brigade left Beirut with its flag lowered due to a planned peace agreement. On the fifth day of the war, Israel ended the battle with Syria, setting the stage for talks.
This was the climax of the Israeli military doctrine's achievements. The doctrine proved to itself and to the world that it is effective and successful both against popular resistance movements and military tactics of classic armies, as it overcame both classic and non-classic methods of battle on Lebanese soil.
Palestinian resistance groups also did their best, including by volunteer operations, aircraft hijacking, and domestic operations, but they led nowhere.
Only then did a man emerge before the eyes of the world who said Israel had been trapped. Ruhollah. And at his hands and under his supervision, we were told of the auspicious birth of a unique form of fighting, comprised of the three elements of faith, jihad, and martyrdom, so that it sets out a new direction, which Ruhollah dubbed Hezbollah. The party of Allah, they will be predominant. And only a few years later, Yitzhak Shamir told the world that Hezbollah are only a different sort of Arabs.
The creation of the Islamic resistance in Lebanon shook the pillars of Israel's security doctrine. The Islamic resistance adopted a special method in the battle against the Israeli forces, which were defeated neither by classic armies nor in non-military battles. Hezbollah put up an unprecedented fight in the history of military science and overcame Israelis. The victory had nothing to do with the geographic elements, as the Palestinian resistance battled Israelis in the same environment. It was not also because Hezbollah was a Lebanese movement, as even the Lebanese and their popular movements fought Israel with the same weapons and on the same lands, but failed to defeat Israel. It was not the territory that gave Hezbollah the upper hand. As Palestinians engaged Israelis in the same territory, so did the Lebanese. Then what made the difference?
Tactic is the element that puts different forms of knowledge at the service of a battle. The more skillful and capable a commander, the fresher and more creative his military tactics would be. It means a capable commander's exceptional leadership and war plans are the results of defining the principles and rules of battle in a specific way. These two factors are in turn rooted in the commander's perception of the principles of war and his detailed assessment of the facts on the ground in the battlefield. The rules of battle can be both firm and flexible. Did Hezbollah develop a special tactic during its years of resistance? Is Hezbollah now in possession of a new technology they have adapted to the battlefield?
In theory, tactic is the knowledge of capabilities, technologies, and details. But in practice, tactic is the ability to create a link between creativity, flexibility, and moderate decision-making in the difficult conditions of the battlefield against a shrewd enemy, coupled with the commander's understanding of the human nature and the impact of the war on his soldiers. Therefore, when we say resistance shattered the enemy on the battlefield, it means the enemy was defeated on the three tactical, practical, and strategic levels. That was what led to the shattering of the enemy's national security doctrine.
Over the years, Hezbollah has been fighting Israel. The resistance developed a military concept of its own. Therefore, what it laid out in southern Lebanon was different from its entire experience of the past.
What we saw in the year 2000 was that enemy soldiers, its special forces and officers, as well as their whole military establishment, were present in Lebanon. However, none of them could give the slightest response to the operation by the resistance, which demonstrates any operation planned by the movement leads to victory, and nothing can be done to counter or stop it. This was the conclusion that led the enemy to retreat.
Israel was twice taken by surprise by Hezbollah. First, by Hezbollah's preparedness for war, and second, by its realization that what it accomplished in the past and the powerful means it used to make those accomplishments were no longer effective against such a well-prepared opponent. The July battle was different from all the past battles Israel had fought since its establishment. Military history proved the superiority of Hezbollah over Israel's military doctrine, which had earlier proved itself effective against the Arabs' both classic and non-classic warfare. Israel faced a new form of resistance, which was fledging back in 1982 and hit its climax in July 2006.
Some say the enemy was on the defensive before the year 2000. However, if we assume that invasion is the key decisive advantages in a war, it was Israel that had the advantage in 2006, as it was Israel that made the assault. We witnessed terrible scenes during the war. The enemy's performance was extremely poor. Researchers said the poor performance was rooted in Israel's failure to balance its forces and its reservists, as well as numerous other problems that made the true reasons behind Israel's failure. But the real reason for its defeat was the performance of enemy's soldiers and officers. Israel's military doctrine failed both in strategic and practical terms, while the failure was also visible in the different aspects of its military concepts and structure. Israeli military organization, soldiers, and officers were also unable to find appropriate methods to fight Hezbollah on the battlefield. But the more significant issue was the resistance movement's superiority to Israel in terms of its military doctrine, theory of the battle, and all strategic, practical, and tactical dimensions.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
Letting Afghanistan slide into total economic and social ruin will have devastating consequences. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by Miria Benjamin and Masuda Sultan, writers. This article is published under the heading Biden hammers a $7 billion nail into Afghanistan's coffin. Stay tuned for more. When the Taliban took control in August 2021, the U.S. government used a pre-existing sanctions regime to freeze the Federal Reserve assets. Formerly, the central bank used to draw on the assets monthly to ensure liquidity and to stabilize the exchange rates. The freeze, together with the sanctions, meant that within weeks, the Afghan economy was in free fall. Inflation soared. People could not withdraw their savings. Salaries could not be paid. Investments became impossible, as did trade. Businesses were bankrupt. Corrupt members of the previous regime had transported so much cash out of the country that there was a shortage of Afghanis, the country's currency. But more could not be obtained because the company that prints them, based in Europe, had to obey U.S. sanctions. And all of this was happening just as an especially harsh winter and an extended drought meant that food and fuel were in short supply and prices were rising steeply. The first problem with this executive order is that it disposes of money on the assumption that it belongs to the Taliban, but it does not. It belongs to the Afghan people, many of whom have their life savings invested in their central bank. We should also be clear that it is not their fault that Taliban are in control. The present rule is the outcome of a poorly conceived and badly executed 20-year social engineering experiment by the United States regime, accompanied by a war-fighting strategy that failed and culminating in a chaotic exit. Another problem with Biden's order is that it entirely misconstrues the purpose of a national reserve. It is not some slush fund that you can hand out to non-governmental organizations, NGOs, for humanitarian aid or use to settle court cases. It's the backbone of a country's fiscal stability. By rights, the assets of the Afghan Central Bank should not have been frozen in the first place. Or if they were, as a precaution, they should have been unfrozen as soon as it became clear that the bank was continuing to function as it did prior to the takeover. Except for a titular Taliban head, the governing board remains the same. The Taliban have made no effort to interfere with the bank's operation, change the banking law, or access the gold that remains in the bank's vaults. Unfreezing the assets need not mean just handing over all the money at once. A plan proposed by Afghan and other banking professionals is to release the money over time in increments of $250 million a month, and to monitor exactly where that money goes and what is done with it. The moment anything seems improper, the freeze could instantly be reinstituted. Instead, Biden decided to make his own unilateral disposition of these funds, a decision that has been denounced by the central bank and, judging from social media, has infuriated Afghans both inside and outside the country. Regarding the $3.5 billion to be set aside to satisfy a lawsuit brought by a group of 9/11 families, it is worth noting that 9/11 victims have received significant compensation already, over $2 million per lost relative, and that other 9/11 family groups oppose this lawsuit. Let's also recall that there were no Afghans among the 9/11 hijackers. 15 of the 19 were from Saudi Arabia. And now, 20 years later, the majority of Afghans were not even born yet in 2001 and certainly bear no blame. And what about the other half of the assets? $3.5 billion that is per the Biden dictum, designated for humanitarian aid? Won't that help the Afghan people? It's hard to decide whether this is the best answer as an ethical or mathematical absurdity. Ethically, what could be more cynical than to steal what literally is someone's life savings on the grounds that you are giving some of it to a charity that will be dispensing handouts to them? As for the math, the NGOs that are intended beneficiaries of Biden's misappropriated largesse have notoriously high overhead. They pay Western salaries, require security and translators and fixers and armored cars and offices, fly in and out from the United States and Europe, and prefer to work in Kabul to avoid the difficult rural areas. According to the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconciliation, that is SIGAR, a U.S. government watchdog agency, overhead typically accounts for a whopping 75 to 80% of their total budgets. It's hard to conceive of a more inefficient way of getting food to hungry Afghans. Has the Biden administration learned nothing from the last 20 years? Consider the White House fact sheet explaining this executive order. It says, even prior to the events of last August, Afghanistan's economy was on the brink. Afghanistan faced poverty rates above 50%. International donor grants financed about 75% of public expenditures and 50% of the government's budget. Rampant corruption crippled sectors that should have been profitable. These problems reflect long-standing structural issues that predated the events of August 2021 and have worsened due to the uncertainty and perceived risk surrounding the Taliban's capacity to run the economy. But prior to last August, who was in charge? The U.S.-backed, U.S.-supported, and in large part, U.S.-engineered Afghan government. Has the White House forgotten this? If there was rampant corruption and the economy was plagued by long-standing structural issues, then these happened on watch. Afghanistan's economy prior to last August was funded, structured, and managed by U.S. Agency for International Development, the World Bank, and the international donors who basically subsidized the country. If there is one lesson Americans can take away from that, it's that they do not know what is good for Afghanistan and should not be running it. Yet this is exactly what Biden has now perpetuated and exacerbated, except now he's taking away the savings of Afghan citizens to do it. While the White House asserts that its plan is for the benefit of the Afghan people and for Afghanistan's future is certainly not best served by making it a permanent charity case and aid recipient. Instead, if Afghans' own assets were returned to the country's economy, they could find an organic post-war recovery in which merchants can once more trade. Small and large businesses can reopen. Homes and shops and businesses can be rebuilt. Farms can be readied for the next planting season. Alternatively, letting Afghanistan slide into total economic and social ruin will have devastating consequences. This disastrous decision needs to be stopped in its tracks. Finally, we call on the American people, regardless of any party affiliation, to let the White House and representatives in Congress know that you are appalled by this decision and call it to be rescinded. We'll be right back.
ثمان يعني
بازار
Historically, each epoch has a particular industrial growth spurt. At present, what we are witnessing is another industrial shift, but this time it is towards knowledge-based products. These items have allowed several processes in our lives and industries to become faster and more efficient. For example, medical devices such as the hemodialysis machine have helped treat illnesses that were previously lost causes. The development of knowledge-based products is also important for the preservation of the environment and protecting it from harmful matter such as industrial waste. It's hard to imagine what our lives would look like without these items.
Hello once again and welcome to another edition of Bozor with me, Sarah Dema. This time, we are going to venture through Iran's knowledge-based productions. We will uncover who makes these products and why they are important to all industries in the country. We will also check out how the government is supporting knowledge-based companies in developing new advanced technologies. So get comfortable and let's start the show. This time, our journey took us to the city of Abhor in Zanjan province, where we visited Fanovaron Zistkore. This knowledge-based company was established nearly a decade ago and is active in three fields of laboratory work, research, and production of advanced machinery. The beating heart of this company is its advanced lab, which is trusted and certified by the National Environmental Protection Agency. Plus, it's part of the country's strategic technology lab network. Its labs are equipped with environmental monitoring technology as well as other instruments to carry out specialized research. Currently, its extensive lab cooperates closely with various industries, including hospitals in the field of environmental pollution monitoring, and acts as a research center for future innovations. This knowledge-based company provides many research services through its laboratories. For example, it previously carried out research projects in the field of oil refinery liquid waste. Another project was research on the treatment of synthetic resin sewage discharge using synthesized photocatalytic nanocomposites. These are used to gauge and remove pollutants in liquids for purification purposes. This company actively exchanges scientific information both nationally and internationally and regularly publishes its findings in academic journals at home and abroad. It collaborates with academic institutions and other research-based firms, providing them with test results. The government has been shifting more and more towards a knowledge-based economy that thrives on research. So knowledge spillover plays a big role in entrepreneurship, especially in cross-discipline research. Having labs in the country dedicated to advancing specialized research is very important. These types of knowledge-based companies help expand products in the market that may have been previously imported. It was the first company in the country to apply science for manufacturing wastewater treatment and purification. Its manufacturing workshops are massive, with a cumulative area of over a hectare to produce the giant water treatment systems. Its machinery is used in industrial settings where water is refined and returned to the system for reuse. Furthermore, its machinery has helped preserve valuable water resources nationwide. Some sectors that apply this technology are the food industry. In general, all industries that use water to produce their products are the end user of this company's water purification machinery. all of the technology produced here is manufactured along the lines of European standards. Its capabilities and products have been exported to regional areas, including Europe. As part of its future goals, this company wants to expand its product list and increase its exports. It's noteworthy that this company has created numerous job opportunities directly and indirectly. Among its staff, this company employs the capabilities of environmental engineers, among other experts, on its roaster. Among its many competitive advantages, one can name the high-quality material that is used for productions of its water purification systems. But that's not all. This company has played a big role in creating technology that preserves all the fine qualities of water using advanced machines for purifications. Iran has been supporting the shift to a knowledge-based society by implementing plans that empower companies in their efforts to develop advanced technology. In fact, in 2010, the government passed laws promoting and supporting knowledge-based companies as part of a legal framework. This has paved the way for boosting innovation and scientific progress, leading to many social and economic advantages. In 2013, there were only 50 knowledge-based firms and startups. That figure has grown over the years to well over 6,000 companies, according to the Vice Presidency Office for Science and Technology. A diverse range of products is manufactured by these firms to meet the country's rising domestic demands. This has saved the country millions of dollars by reducing expensive imports. Iran makes thousands of different types of specialized technologies. The amount of progress of knowledge-based firms in the fields of medical devices, energy, and information communication technology is the most noticeable. Aircraft maintenance, mining, petrochemicals, and pharmaceuticals are among other disciplines researchers are focusing on. And exports of knowledge-based products are estimated to reach over $1 billion by the end of this year. That's based on figures from the Science and Technology Office. The National Innovation Fund says tech firms and knowledge-based companies raked in over $5 billion in revenues last year. Some 40 knowledge-based companies are listed in the stock market as well. So far, the government has implemented numerous policies and plans to help support knowledge-based companies over the years. Some of these schemes include loans with low interest rates, tax exemptions, and easing commercial license issuances. The goal is to encourage the development of Iran's tech ecosystem and boost lucrative high-tech productions for exports.
Research steered by scientific investigation plays a huge role in product development. At its core, advanced technology is created by adding valuable features to items that have specialized uses. And academic and research institutions are the bridge between ideas and the commercialization of products. Several universities across Iran are providing services to help support knowledge-based startups.
High technology is a product of advancements in national academic and scientific research. Iran possesses a lot of intellectual prowess as a whole. Evidence of this can be seen by the high number of academic publications both nationally and internationally. Nearly 70,000 academic articles were published in 2020 alone to show for it. Figures from the International Web of Science show Iran was globally ranked 16th in 2019 for its citation work. Numerous knowledge-based companies that provide valuable research and products are born out of university, tech park, and trade zone incubators. These establishments provide platforms that support the creation of new businesses in various fields of advanced tech development as they start up. Incubators offer services to entrepreneurial teams to successfully execute their ideas and help them compete in national and global markets. Moreover, incubators are an access channel for services such as workspaces and facilities, technical and legal consultations. These are important for the sustainability of both existing firms as well as innovative startup businesses. The goal is to increase regional economic growth and diversify the national economy. Such development support also strengthens the tech ecosystem and improves investment opportunities. Electrical cables are an essential part of our lives. Cables bring power to our homes and offices, countries, and continents. They channel power and signals that make equipment hum and engines run, from oil rigs and broadcast studios to cars and trains, commercial buildings, and factory floors. Cables keep information flowing, facilitating a non-stop stream of words and images that transcend speed and geographical limits.
In this episode, we're going to talk about the vast world of Iwan's wire and cable productions. We wanted to see who makes these items and why they are so important to numerous industries across the country. Plus, we will check out some of this industry's contributions to the national economy.
To become more familiar with wire production, we visited Behta Padideh Alborz. It began its activity 5 years ago in the field of production and distribution of wires and cables. This company makes dozens of different types of wires and cables. Some are used in telecommunications, construction, electrical appliances, and automobile manufacturing. It also makes more complicated cables, such as coaxial cables. This type has an inner conductor surrounded by an insulating layer that is covered by conductive shielding. Currently, its production facilities have the capacity to make millions of meters of cables each month. Some 40 people work directly at this company, and 200 others are indirectly employed. It manufactures cables through a process of pulling either copper or aluminum cords. Advanced machines are used to stretch the metal conductors to the desired width. After this, depending on the use, the strands are either braided together or aligned and prepared for insulation covering. It is worth mentioning that this company has been producing wires and cables that were previously imported. Its productions have gained a significant share of the domestic market too. Such domestic productions have prevented large amounts of capital flight throughout the years.
It might be interesting to know that 95% of raw materials needed to produce wires and cable can be domestically supplied. Because Iran is rich with natural resources, raw materials such as copper, aluminum, and petrochemical products are easily accessible to this industry. There is a small number of items that still need to be imported, such as sheath required for aluminum cables.
One of the advantages of this company is its diverse product range. It also has the capability of producing special types of cables to meet specific customer requirements that may currently not exist in the country. Remarkably, a key competitive advantage of this company is its technical know-how and experience. This has helped it manufacture its production machines and equipment and localize this technology in the country. Using its own machines has other benefits too, such as being able to maintain and control the quality of their products. Quality issues are very important in the cable industry. This cable manufacturer follows stringent specifications for the quality and safety of its wires and cables. Products are checked in the quality control center for their performance as well as to match other standardizations necessary in the sector. It's important to have the highest quality because wires are meant to last for years and sometimes for decades. Therefore, this company uses the highest grade of raw material to produce its items. As part of its future goals, this company is adding new products to its portfolio, such as fiber optic cables. But that's not all. This manufacturer stands on the cusp of exporting its products and plans to expand its market reach to neighboring countries as well.
Generally speaking, the country's wire and cable industry has witnessed exponential advancements over the years and has been developed in line with modern technical knowledge. Based on statistics from the industry, Iran produces more than what is needed for domestic consumption, so export-oriented production is an important aspect to keep this industry thriving.
The National Wire and Cables Producers Association says over 80% of the country's needs are supplied domestically and productions compete in quality with global brands. But the association says that exports are negligible compared to the large production outputs. Moreover, it estimates that Iran has the potential to sell at least $600 million worth of goods to neighboring countries annually. Yet the value of current exports is less than $100 million. So why is this? It's because this sector is only working at 30% of its entire capacity as it faces several obstacles for expansion and development. Industry participants say they can work at full production load if many of these challenges are removed. Increased production can also lead to more exports. Some of these challenges include the supply of machinery. More often than not, business owners are forced to go through multiple intermediaries to get the equipment they need. Doing so is time-consuming and adds to their costs. Other issues revolve around export barriers such as Iran's tariff system. Industry analysts say this system has inflated the end price of local products, sapping the country's competitiveness and exportability. Manufacturers say strict government regulations have also led to many businesses foregoing the path of exports altogether.
The biggest consumers of wires and cables in the country are in the telecommunications sectors and electrical power industry. Electricity is the mother of all industries and is heavily dependent on wires and cables. Iran is capable of producing large amounts of electricity and fully supplies domestic needs. It exports electrical power too. This sector requires high voltage cables to be able to distribute electricity nationally and also internationally.
According to the Electricity Industry Syndicate, domestic firms already produce high-voltage power cables and are ready to export their goods and services to international markets. Previously, these cables were imported, but domestic production has reduced imports by 20%. As the country develops its manufacturing industries, it also creates an enormous demand for electricity. The national power grid has been expanded by 60,000 kilometers in the last 4 years to meet growing requirements. Consequently, manufacturers had to set up production to supply wires and cables to the electrical power industry. We looked at some figures from the National Power Generation Transmission and Distribution Company. Data showed around 80% of the productions of wires and cables in Iran is supplied to the power industry alone. The remaining 20% are used in electrical appliance, automobile, and construction industries, among others. It can be said that wires and cables play an important role in the electrical and electronic industry. The increasing demand for power, light, and communication has kept demand high for wires and cables. This industry has so much potential, promising a bright future for further development and growth. Iran has many natural resources. Some are agricultural and some other are natural wonders enjoyed by tourists and locals alike. Still, other resources have to be extracted by mining. The mining industry is a very important component of the economic health of Iran, contributing billions in a given year. This modern industry is also heavily dependent on the discoveries and innovations made by knowledge-based companies. These firms are often pioneers of development, opening new horizons for industries while making industrial processes more efficient and less costly.
One of the biggest capacities of Iran is its rich natural resources. Yes, we are talking about mines. They have brought tremendous profits while creating numerous jobs. This week, we will look at the mining industry and some of its related traits. We also want to uncover how this industry continues to expand and who is helping with its development. So let's start the show.